today, or this week, is World Series week, right? And so I have a story. I have a story for World Series week, which is, do you remember that Satan challenged God to a baseball game? God just smiled and proclaimed, "You haven't got a chance. I've got all the great players. I have Mickey Mantle. I have Babe Ruth. I have Stan Musial." And the devil just gave his evil laugh and said, "Well, that all may be so, but I have all the umpires." Okay, that's dedicated to my husband and anybody else in the room who might have been an umpire. Sorry about that. So, when you really think about it, this image of Satan is comical, is it not? It is great fodder for jokes and for stories and for cartoons. In the book, The Alternatives, New Approaches to Traditional Christian Beliefs, how many of you remember this? We studied this book a few years ago. Great. Here's what William Fisher says. He says, "The popular view of Satan is somewhat comical. He is caricatured as being small in stature, red in color, with small horns on his forehead, a pointed tail, and a pitchfork. And a pitchfork, the better to prod people into sinning and damnation. He's also known as having cloven hooves and very much resembling the Greek mythical god Pan." And so stories and movies depicting Satan and God in a battle of custody over people's souls really does permeate our culture. It's hard to really avoid it. And here's the way it works. Sometimes God wins. Sometimes it's a tie and they have to flip a coin, okay, as this cartoon shows. And sometimes the devil wins. And about this, William Fisher says, "This is a rather frightening consideration because it accords more power to Satan than to God. It would make us wonder if we have a right to call God Almighty. Perhaps if this were the case, if Satan does sometimes win, we would more appropriately call God partly mighty." But that's not what we affirm every Sunday morning, is it? Join me in our, I know it's out of order, but join me in our foundational affirmation. Join me. There is only one presence and one power in the universe and at work in my life. God, the good, omnipotent. Only one presence, one power, not two. And if we truly and honestly believe that this one power is all good, all loving, and present everywhere in the universe, how could there be an alternate power? How could there ever be any place where God is not? And so you might ask, well, how did this idea of a devil, of Satan, just permeate religious doctrine, especially Christianity? How did that happen? Well, you know, way back before the days of Jesus, the ancient Hebrews were the only ones in a totally polytheistic world to really understand that there was only one God. And they believed that every single thing that happened on this earth was an act of the one God. Remember the Mosaic Covenant? Remember? Anybody remember it? Yeah, okay. Hopefully I do, okay? The Mosaic Covenant. "Please God, and you shall be rewarded. Displease God, and you shall be punished." And so when something bad showed up in the life of an ancient Hebrew, he or she didn't blame the devil. The thinking was that the person had done something to displease God. And one modern rabbi wrote, "If a child had walked around ancient Israel sporting a t-shirt that said, 'The devil made me do it,' nobody would even know what that meant." Because in the Old Testament, there is absolutely nothing about the devil as an alternate power to God. In fact, in Hebrew, the word was shahahan, which meant adversary, obstacle, stumbling block. Now, perhaps through the years while the ancient Hebrews were just conquered by one group after another, maybe they picked up this idea in their folklore of an opposing power. Some Bible scholars say maybe it came from the Babylonians, maybe it came from the Persians, maybe it even came from Greek mythology, because we saw what how closely Pan resembled the devil. So, actually, I'm going to try it again. In the New Testament, there's very little. Can you hear me? No, okay. Okay, not my will, right? Okay. All right, I guess I'm into standard dates. Okay. In the New Testament, there's really very little about the devil also. There is one story, however, that someone asked me about a few weeks ago when we did the Unity 101 class. And this is a story where, if taken literally, it does really seem like the devil is an alternate power battling with God over the custody of a soul. And you know what? Not just any old soul, but the soul of Jesus. And this story is commonly called the Temptations, and it's found in all three synoptic gospels, Matthew, Mark, and Luke. Now, Mark's version typically is very short, two sentences actually, so if you want the Cliff Notes version, Mark's your man, okay? But Luke and Matthew tell longer, more detailed stories that are pretty much identical, except the order is different. So today we're going to look at Matthew's version, which is in chapter 4, verses 1 through 4. There are three trials, and you'll see in a moment why I'm calling them trials and not temptations. There are three, and this is number one. Then Jesus was led by Spirit into the wilderness to be tempted by the devil. After fasting 40 days and 40 nights, he was hungry. The tempter came to him and said, "If you are the Son of God, tell these stones to become bread." Jesus answered, It is written, man shall not live on bread alone, but on every word that comes from the mouth of God. Strike one for Satan, right? Okay. Now, in order to take a look at what this story means to us metaphysically, symbolically, in order to plow through the actual events as they're told and figure out what is the lesson for each one of us, we're going to start with the setting of the story, okay? The story is set in the wilderness, right? And Charles Fillmore tells us that the wilderness represents undisciplined, uncultivated thoughts, okay? And the amount of time was how long? 40 days and nights. And the number 40 is a sacred number, appearing again and again in the scriptures. What does it mean? Does anybody know? As long as it takes, absolutely. Or, in other words, the amount of time necessary to complete the work. And did you notice who led Jesus into the wilderness? Was it Satan? It was Spirit. Some versions say the Holy Spirit. And the reason he is being led into the wilderness is to fast. The metaphysical definition of fast is to deny falsehood, to abstain from error thought in order to know our oneness. And last but not least, the very word temptation, having that connotation today about being lured into sin or lured into error, in the early Greek, didn't mean that at all. The word was prazo, and it meant a proving ground, a testing, a trying. So someone said to me today, right before service started, "Is this the day you're going to talk about the devil?" And I said, "Yes. Remember I told you 2 weeks ago, today is the day that we deal with the devil. Are you ready? Are you ready?" Okay. Here we go. All right. So, Charles Fillmore tells us that Satan represents all the thoughts in man and humankind that fight against and are adverse to truth. And this means, if you put together all the other metaphysical terms we've thought about this morning, this means the temptation of Jesus took place within himself. The place of overcoming is within the consciousness of humankind, according to Charles Fillmore. So it's this internal dialogue that Jesus is having with himself. And in order to understand why Jesus might be having such a dialogue, we have to realize that the temptations immediately follow the symbolic ritual of Jesus' baptism. And I'm quoting now from Bible scholar Ed Townley, the author of the blog Interpret This. He says, this moment, the moment of Jesus' baptism, is when Jesus realizes the truth of his Christ identity and the spiritual purpose for which he has assumed human form. And then he asks the question, what next? What next? That's the question that these temptations answer, that these trials, I'm going to say from now on, answer. Because I think this whole temptation story is about Jesus' preparation after the inspirational moment of his baptism, when God says, "This is my son in whom I'm well pleased." Then Jesus has to be able to take all of that inspiration and bring it into manifestation in the physical world. And in doing so, we are going to discover today not only a framework for so much of Jesus' teachings, but also a way, a blueprint for us to be God's expression, to be physical, spiritual beings having a human experience. So it's pretty exciting. And on a literal level, of course, Jesus is hungry. I mean, he's fasted for 40 days and 40 nights, right? Some of us can barely make it through the Sunday service without running downtown. So we all get that, right? We get it. We get it. But more than that, if you think about it, if this is the very beginning of Jesus' ministry, he is about to give up his livelihood as a carpenter, a tecton. He's about to give all that up in order to just to, you know, step out literally, wandering the dusty roads of Galilee and Jerusalem, and he very well may be asking himself, from whence comes my daily bread now? Where does my daily bread come from? And he quotes Deuteronomy 8:3, which is from the Israelites also wandering in the wilderness, where it says, man does not live on bread alone, but on every word that comes from the mouth of the Lord. Now, it seems to me that Jesus has two understandings here. First of all, he understands that anytime we look and we see lack or limitation, we're in Satan consciousness. But more than that, we are in Satan consciousness anytime we expect anything from this outer realm to feed us. I believe Jesus is telling us here, we are not fed by anything on the outer. We are fed by turning within, knowing our oneness with the One. And in that sense, we are fed far more than food. We are fed abundance and love and peace and wisdom and wholeness and all of the rest. And we need to know that even here, the word bread means more than just physical bread. It symbolizes universal substance, the living energy out of which everything is made, sustenance for spirit, mind, and body. Now we have to realize Jesus is not telling us that we have to give up all of our needs or all of the pleasures of this world. He will say later, I have food that you know not of. And so, no, we're not asked to give up all of our worldly desires and pleasures. We are simply asked to navigate this world in such a way that we turn to the Christ first and then figure out how we show up in our spirit as our spiritual selves. Does that make sense? So, we know also that Jesus said to us, seek first the kingdom and all these things will be given unto you. So I think that is an important lesson for us from the first trial, from the first temptation. Are you ready for temptation number two? All right, here we go. Trial number two. Then the devil took Jesus to the holy city, Jerusalem, to the highest point of the temple, and said to him, "If you are the Son of God, jump off. For the scriptures say, he will order his angels to protect you, and they will hold you up with their hands so that you won't even hurt your foot on a stone." So how about this? Now we've got Satan spouting scripture, right? Only he's quoting it, but actually he's misquoting it. But Jesus hardly takes a moment to come to his decision. You can see his understanding evolving here. He says, "The scriptures also say you must not test the Lord your God." You must not test the Lord your God. So Jesus is taken in thought now to the pinnacle of the temple, the very highest top of the temple, and has this thought for a moment that he might just jump off to be, I guess, on sort of a celestial bungee jump and caught by angels, right? Now, why in the world would Jesus do such a thing? Well, because he knew fully the old Hebrew piece of folklore that said anyone who performed such a feat would be the Messiah. And Jesus fails. He doesn't want to be that kind of Messiah. But the point is, this one's a little hard for us to figure out, is it not? About what does this one mean for our own lives? I mean, I doubt... Well, I'm not really so sure, but I doubt that any of us is going to climb to the top of this church and jump off to prove our spiritual identity. I hope not, because I don't think our insurance would cover that. I'm not sure. Anyway. So, but Jesus, even knowing that by this one exploit, he could win over the whole crowd. He could convert everybody in the whole area. But still, he failed. He decided not to do it. Instead, he said... Again, quoting Deuteronomy, "You must not test the Lord your God." Now, know that in this particular... Oh, I forgot to do my thing. Strike two. Strike two. All right, Satan's down two now. Here we go. It's important to know that in both the second and third trials, and we've talked about this before, we need to remember what kind of Messiah was expected. The Messiah that the ancient Hebrews were expecting was a great warrior, a King David type, someone who would be strong enough to subdue their enemies, a Messiah who would rule through might, intimidation, and perhaps even supernatural powers. But Jesus refuses to claim his messiahship by smoke and mirrors. He has a different plan. And Charles Fillmore writes here that what Jesus demonstrates is there should be no display of spiritual power for personal glory. No display for personal glory. So as I take this into my own life and think about it, a haunting question comes to me. First of all, I want to share with you that a lot of Bible scholars think that this particular trial is about something with which we can all identify. It's about personal pride. Anybody ever been there? Okay. It's about popularity, striving for popularity, and it's about our quest for public recognition. So for me, I have to step back and ask myself, in what ways have I tried to look good in front of other people? I might be trying it right now, actually, but anyway. In what way have I tried to just impress people? In what way have I tried to do that? And for me, honestly, as I look back over my life, I could say sometimes it's been in possessions, sometimes it's been in relationships, sometimes it's been my education, my professional status, my kids, my job. I see a lot of you shaking your heads. We've all been there, haven't we? That we look for those outside things to fulfill us. And so maybe our lesson here is that those earthly quests that we hold dear, none of them is lasting. And perhaps that's why Jesus says later, in the Sermon on the Mount, "Do not lay up for yourself treasures on earth, where moth and rust destroy and where thieves break in and steal, but lay up for yourself treasures in heaven, where neither moth nor rust destroys and where neither thieves and where thieves do not break in and steal." And so maybe our lesson here, at least my lesson here, and I leave it up to you to decide yours, my lesson here is to look at my life and say, okay, when do I look for the to the world for my purpose? And when do I look to my spiritual purpose? Because the song that the choir did so beautifully this morning, Witness, is so true. Our souls are a witness to a sacred purpose, all that we're born to be. And that is eternal. That is everlasting. So finally, we come to our third trial. In our third trial, the devil says to Jesus, he takes him, first of all, on a high, exceedingly high mountain, this version says, and shows him all the kingdoms of the world below and their glory. And then he says to him, "All these things I will give to you if you fall down and worship me." And Jesus replies, "Away with you, Satan." In some translations, "Get behind me, Satan. For it is written, you shall worship the Lord your God, and him only will you serve." Jesus is not here for the kinds of kingdoms that are running through his mind at that moment. That's not why he's here. He is here. Oh, I keep forgetting my strikes. Strike three, the devil's out, okay? Strike three, the devil's out. Going to be over there, but anyway, it's okay. Strike three. Everybody with me? Okay, the devil's out. So, Jesus knows that his mission on this earth is to be the Christ in expression and to worship and serve only the divine. Now, I know we all have a connotation of worship, and it does mean to bestow, metaphysically, it means to bestow love on, but it also means to identify oneself with things of spirit. And so when we're identifying with the Christ of our being, we are in worship, no matter where we are. And yet, okay, Russell, you're a guest, close your eyes, we'll be honest. Do we always do that? No, we don't always do that. We want to, right? But we don't always do that. And here's what Charles Fillmore says about that. He says, to worship the devil is to worship personality, to live in personal consciousness and give it the substance of our life and thought. To worship the devil is to worship personality. Now, I know we have a psychological meaning of the word personality, but many of you know, in Unity, we mean something a little different by that. Our personality is our human persona. It's all those attitudes and thoughts we have about ourselves that usually come from others. Where do they come from? Anybody name anybody? Any group? Parents, family, teachers, society. And we take this on and we think this is who we are. And in contrast to that, we have an individuality. That's our Christ self, our true nature, our I am. And the thing is, our personality changes depending on what role we play, doesn't it? I mean, I'm playing one role here talking to you. I'll play another role if I'm out, you know, playing in the yard with my grandkids. I mean, it changes depending on what we're doing. But our individuality never, ever changes. It's always, always the same. And here's an interesting piece. Charles Fillmore says, our personality acts as a veil or mask that covers our true individuality. We can use our personality as a mask that covers our true selves. So, it's almost time for Halloween, right? We're going to be seeing a few masks this week. These are the top Halloween mask of 2017, among the top. There were some I didn't want to show, okay? So you can look them up if you want to. I know not everybody's picking out their cell phones and looking up it, okay. But really, if you want to buy one, you better hurry because time is short, and you can find them on Halloween Express. But here's the point. Here is the point. If we see anybody walking around this week with masks like this, are we for one moment going to think that that mask is their true identity? No, we know exactly what it is. It's a mask they're wearing. And yet when we deal with ourselves and each other, sometimes we don't see the Christ within because the mask blocks the way. And so that's, I think, one of the meanings of this third trial. It's very important that encountering this temptation, this trial in his mind, Jesus realized that even though he was going to be in human skin, he was in human skin, his mission was to live from his divine identity, and so is ours. I believe our message here is to remove those masks, to remove them and turn to the Christ of our being and live from that, not according to the expectations of other people, even those people that we respect. Now, I realize that Jesus didn't have the advantage of Pinterest or, you know, Twitter, but we do. And so I found this. This is from the cartoonist David Hayward. And it is, I love this. It says, "The expectations of others were the bars I used for my own cage." Isn't that true? That is so true. And New Thought minister Michael Beckwith says, "We make so many adjustments in our personality that we no longer hear our unique soul call." He goes on to say that sometimes we can become so fragmented, forgetting who we really are, that we walk into a new situation, and I'm sorry, I have to walk away from the microphone to do this. We walk into a new situation, and we say to ourselves, okay, "How can I navigate this so I'm looking good?" The rumbling of the microphone. However, sadly, I think some of us walk into a room and we say to ourselves, "How can I navigate this so that people will not see my flaws, my faults, my lack of worthiness?" And the thing is, and this I believe is the meaning of this trial, when we learn to turn from this world to the Christ of our being, we are going to ask different questions. And the questions are going to be, "How can I love in this environment? How can I be love here? How can I, as Charles Fillmore says, be everything I can imagine God to be in this situation? How can I be the attributes of spirit?" And that's what Jesus is coming to understand in the third trial, that he is here to be all the attributes of spirit. And he will tell us, "These things that I do, so too you can do, you shall do," absolutely. And so in these trials, Jesus overcomes Satan mind. All right, there's a fast review of today's lesson. In case you missed anything. All right, here we go. That's where we were. Jesus overcomes all of these trials. And one Bible scholar said, really, they're the same trial. And in a way, they are. They're all about turning away from this world to our true identity. And how does Jesus do this? He turns away from personal needs in the first trial, from gaining fame in the second trial, from achieving personal power in the third trial. He turns away from all of these to the greater reality of the kingdom of God. And in each statement, he exercises the power of the word, which we've talked about before. First, issuing a statement of denial, and then affirming a strong truth, his or from the scriptures. Then he makes, and this is important, we can't just deny and affirm, we have to take this next step. Then he makes the conscious choice, as our daily word says, to become spirit in action. This is our fifth principle. He walks the talk. He lives the truth that he really knows. He acts on the truth, not the illusions in his mind. Because in the end, Satan is an illusion that we have all created together. individually in our own minds, passed down through time, and collectively as a society. The devil, Jesus says in John 8:44, the devil is a liar. The devil is a lie and a liar, actually. And as Reverend Ed Townley writes, the devil is that fear-based negative voice that consistently feeds us lies. Lies that we are limited, lies that we are separate from God and one another, lies that we are unworthy. In our human skin, sometimes we are tempted. How many of us are tempted to listen to that voice? I mean, I think we have to fight it every day, maybe every moment. Some of us are tempted to listen to that negative self-talk, telling us to make our choices based on need, greed, and fear. But once we learn, once we realize that this insistent voice does not speak truth, we can choose to dissolve it and all the power we've invested in it. And then, realizing our oneness with all that is, we can say, as Jesus said, "Get behind me, Satan, go away." And then, like Jesus, our ministry on this earth begins. And so it is. So let's take a moment now just to reaffirm our great truth about the divine. That there is only one presence and one power in the universe and at work in our lives. God, the good, omnipotent, and so it is. Together, there is only one presence and one power in the universe and at work in my life. God, the good, omnipotent, and so it is.